Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Gatsisakwas Ellen Gabriel is sharing lessons from a life as an Indigenous land defender in her new book. When the Pine Needles Fall, Indigenous Acts of Resistance is written as a conversation between the well-known Mohawk activist and historian Sean Carleton. Starting from Gabriel's childhood, the book chronicles her experience as a spokesperson during the Oka Crisis, or the Mohawk Crisis, as she calls it, and her years advocating for Indigenous rights worldwide. In the process, it models a path of activism that's rooted in the land. Much of this advocacy work has taken place right here in Montreal, where Gabriel is often a speaker at rallies and vigils that honor Indigenous life. CKUT spoke with her and co-author Sean Carleton about that advocacy and the other lessons from the book. Take a listen.
So maybe I'll get started by asking you both to introduce yourselves.
My name is Gatsisakwas, I'm Ellen Gabriel. I'm from the Kanyakahaga community in Gunnasaga.
My name is Sean Carleton. I'm a settler historian at the University of Manitoba out here in Treaty 1 territory.
Yeah, and so thank you both for coming on CKUT. We're here to talk about your new book, When the Pine Needles Fall. And it's a conversation between the two of you about Ellen, your life, and especially your activism. Can you tell me a little bit about how this project came about?
Well, I was very fortunate enough about 10 years ago to meet Ellen at a talk at Trent University in Peterborough, Ontario, in Anishinaabe Territory. And I kept in touch with Ellen about some of the activism that she was doing in her community, particularly to stop ongoing land theft and housing development in particular. And I had reached out to possibly do an interview for a magazine that I was volunteering with called Canadian Dimension, activist magazine. And we had a number of conversations where she was, you know, saying in order to understand what was going on at the time, and this was about 2017, we really need to understand what was happening in 1990. And in order to understand what was going on in 1990, we need to understand the last 300 years of history. And as a historian, that's, you know, was very, you know, I think important to me. And at the end, I had said to Ellen, wow, I mean, have you ever thought of writing a book? And she had said, yes, but things always kept getting in the way. And all the things that kept getting in the way are the amazing activism that she does. So we decided to continue our conversations and create a book out of all of the things that Ellen has done, but also all of the lessons that she teaches us about what needs to happen in the future to make a better world.
Yeah, and I know the title also is the title, Ellen, of your documentary film from last year, and that film was trying to sort of take back the narrative around the events more broadly known as the Oka Crisis in 1990. And I'm wondering, you know, this is obviously how you became such a nationally recognized figure as a spokesperson for the Mohawk resistance. You know, that story has been told so much, and those images from that period were really nationally broadcast. You know, anyone who was watching TV at the time would have seen your face, right? How was that process of sort of looking back at that period and trying to take the narrative and tell a different story about that time?
Yeah, I mean, the story has been told a lot of times, but incorrectly. It's been told by Western media's perspective, and so it was really important for me to figure out a way to take it back. And as Sean said, you know, it's been a challenge for me to finish writing a book, so... you know, Sean graciously and generously provided some time for me, but The whole issue is about the land. It's not about warriors with guns. It's not about Oka and them, their victimization. Yeah, Oka caused the crisis, so that's why I prefer people to either call it the Gunasadaga and Ganawage siege of 1990 or the Mohawk crisis, because Oka, Canada, Quebec, they all caused this crisis, and they continue to steal our land. And so this is just, you know, we can focus on the individual stories and experiences, but at the end of the day, it's a collective story of land dispossession. And it's, you know, the Gunasadaga 273 years of resistance is a good starter, but it just scratches the surface, you know. And some of the things that she says it was incorrect. You know, Oka is not near Gunasadaga. Oka is Gunasadaga. Oka is the colonial word, name that was given to it by the Sulpician priests. So, you know, learning history, it's just like learning about Canada's genocidal history, not just for the Indian residential school. You know, we have to reclaim that narrative too. But the centuries of pain and hardship that they have caused Indigenous people on Turtle Island because of greed, because of settler colonialism's agenda, you know, the thing that I hear often in history is, you know, the settlers who came here thought, oh, there's an infinite amount of resources, and they had to kill the Indigenous people in order to get those resources. They had to learn how to survive. So the layers and layers and layers of a story is not just a 78-day siege. It's what happened before that. It's the efforts before that. It's also about oppressive colonial laws that continue to deny Indigenous people the right to self-determination. It's just like land acknowledgements. They're just very symbolic, and that's about it. The rhetoric of people like Justin Trudeau to say it, where, you know, the Indigenous people are the most important relationship we know, is a lie. So it's getting through the lies, the misconceptions, and leaving a legacy that tells the truth, not creates this sort of machismo warrior resistance, because women were involved in that resistance, and elders and children. You know, we are a community, our nation of people. So it's really important that that was clarified, and to show the role of the women in the film, as I did.
I'd like to pick up on this theme of history and retelling history, because, you know, Sean, as a historian who I know is active not just in the classroom, but also sort of in public forums and a public discourse to try and correct the way that settler Canadian media and politics and discourse talks about Indigenous resistance and talks about land struggles. You know, I'm wondering if you could say sort of what moment we're at right now in Canada in terms of like actually understanding these issues from more of an Indigenous perspective, because, you know, Ellen, you were speaker in Montreal on Orange Shirt Day, and CKUT was there last week, and speaking to people in the crowd as well about what brought them out on that day. And, you know, one of the people we spoke to was very angry and very upset. And she told us, you know, we didn't learn the real story of Indian residential schools. We didn't learn the real story of Quebec. And we're still not learning the real story. So I'm wondering, maybe first Sean and then Ellen, if you can talk about where you feel like we're at and maybe where we need to go in telling these stories.
Well, maybe just quickly then on the history point, and I'll let Ellen tell us where we need to go, because she's my mentor and I listen to Ellen as much as possible. you know, I think in terms of history, you know, one of the things is that colonial mythology serves to legitimize colonial oppression policies. And while we like to think that, you know, many of these mythologies are being challenged, you know, I think it's more that they mutate, and there are always constantly new ways that colonizers are justifying their possession of Indigenous territory. So it's more that the mythologies change over time rather than you know, are eradicated. And I think we do need to think about the global context of colonial mythology, that, you know, some of the colonial mythology in Canada is being challenged, and yet, you know, we're seeing all over the world, including in the Middle East, that these ways of justifying the unjustifiable continue to be very evident in our world. And it takes a lot, that, you know, because really what we're talking about is power, the power to represent reality in ways that benefits colonialism and capitalism. And, you know, people are, I think, as a result of 1990 and things like Idle No More, many Canadians are being made aware of how colonial mythology works. But there's a lot of work, I think, to do both in Canada and around the world to really help people understand the truth. And I think I'll pass things over to Ellen, but I know that one of the things that Murray Sinclair always says is that he feels that Canada has rushed reconciliation and left the truth behind. There's still a lot of truth to be told here. And maybe Ellen can expand a little bit about, you know, what is it going to take to move forward.
The Truth and Reconciliation's recommendations talks about, you know, judges, lawyers, teachers, social workers, everybody from a child to an adult should learn about Canada's genocidal history. And yet it's not. It's not being taught. The curriculum in the schools remains pretty much the same as when I was in high school in the 70s. And so we're looking at a time when colonization has been repackaged to Indigenous people. The public is being placated by politicians to say, look at what a good job we're doing in reconciliation. I think providing funds to make events that talk about the truth are the great ones, the ones where the truth is totally ignored, but yet receives funding for reconciliation, are the ones that I think we could do without. And so it shouldn't come down to a matter of money. It should come down to a matter of justice. And that's not where we're at. We're really at figuring out how do we get past these walls and these challenges of resistance and denialism when the leaders of this country and the educators of this country, in fact, have remained silent on correcting the version of history that they have come to know. You know, Kairos, which is an amalgamation of different churches, created this blanket exercise. And when I've participated in it, it sits at a blanket. There's, I don't know how many blankets you could put out, but they represent Turtle Island. And each time, you know, a war happens, people have to leave that blanket, roll it up. And so you're ending up with a history lesson, but also a visualization of how much land has been taken, how much people have been killed. And I think that's the kind of exercises that need to be done in schools and are not. We need to have a moratorium on all development. Any land that is not being used should be returned to Indigenous peoples for land back. I think people have a misconception of what land back means. Like, we don't want the keys to your house. We just want to be able to have a decision and consent to how our traditional territories are being used. So there's a lot of things to unpack, but the fact is that the truth, as Sean has said, the truth is absent, and actually reconciliation is absent as well.
The events in 1990, I think, are a good example of the way that the processes and the systems that are set up for justice or due diligence, fairness in cases like this can fail, and activists are forced to put their bodies on the line for the things that really, in this case, looking back, I think it's a pretty clear consensus that the Mohawk community was entitled to. I'm wondering if you could speak about what is the kind of practice of an activist life in a country where there are all these sort of channels for reconciliation and for justice that, you know, people say, well, this is not actually serving us. How do you go from there?
Yeah, well, the justice system doesn't work for Indigenous peoples. Yellowhead did some research on the injunctions that Indigenous peoples put against corporations and found out that, you know, 99% of the time we lose. There have been Supreme Court decisions that have been in favor of Indigenous people and have not been won. But for, you know, that what I think what the crisis did was wake up people, like especially Indigenous people, and to say that, you know, we are nations. You know, we have that right to be loyal to our own nations and not and reject Canada's citizenship, as we do under the great law of the Haudenosaunee people. The crisis really brought to the forefront the issue of the land and, you know, the lessons to be learned, I guess, as an activist. And I'm really not comfortable with that term because it's my survival, you know. We're trying to survive in a colonial patriarchal world. So I prefer a land defender, but, you know, whatever labels people understand, that's fine. But you need to take care of yourself. You need to know when your limits are. You need to be able to have time with your family and being able to, you know, have a relationship with the land. That's, you know, it's really difficult to have a relationship with the land when everything is concrete. You know, where I come from, there's a lot of trees. It's beautiful. There's birds singing, but it's also what's happened in my community is that, you know, it's lawless. Anything goes because now the SQ are saying they don't want another crisis, so they're not going to do anything to address the issue of threats to our safety and the kind of activities that are going on in my community. So there's an exploitation within the community where people like myself are helpless to do anything or else be threatened. And so I think as an activist, it's easier to work outside the community rather than inside, because inside the community is the politics are different. So as an activist, I feel like I failed. You know, I failed to be able to fulfill those roles as a Haudenosaunee woman, as a Haudenosaunee person, simply because of assimilation and colonization. And the fact that it's so abrasive and coercive that people accept it, they assimilate it, they assimilate capitalism. So, you know, to be an activist or a land defender, you have to be solid in the arguments that you're going to use. You can't just say, oh, it's my land, so, you know, I have a right to do this. It really is about, well, okay, how do you have this right? And if you don't know that, you will... Your arguments will fail.
And Sean, was there anything you wanted to add as well?
I think just quickly that readers of the book who have not met Ellen or have met Ellen but haven't had the opportunity to really learn and listen to her will see, you know, that there's this deep love for the land that motivates all of the things that Ellen talks about in the book, whether we're thinking about her role as the spokesperson in 1990, advocating for Indigenous women as a president of Quebec Native Women, or the work that she does on the international stage of the United Nations. There's this love for the land and for wanting to ensure that future generations have the ability to feel that love. And capitalism and colonialism, they just want the land for to exploit it, to take. I think I'm struck, because I was reading the book again over the weekend, how different that is, and that I think non-Indigenous people in particular that don't necessarily have that grounded relationship to the land really need to learn from people like Ellen about how they can infuse their actions in thinking about building a better world from that perspective, rather than trying to grab it and take it and use it and exploit it. And if more people could act that way and learn from people like Ellen, I think we'd have a better shot at having a better world and living a better world for the future generations. And I hope that readers will learn and take some of those lessons and put them into action to help make the world that we live in a better place.
That was Gutsy Tsakwas, Ellen Gabriel, and Sean Carleton speaking about their new book, When the Pine Needles Fall, Indigenous Acts of Resistance. I'm Jules Bijal, reporting with the Local Journalism Initiative. Thanks for listening.
of the song is so typical. So I fight against the fear to say what you deserve to hear. And I'm reeling. This feeling you have me.
Bird note. Birds feed their families in a variety of ways. Baby chickens and ducklings are left to peck and forage on their own from the time they hatch. Ospreys fly in with fish in their talons. Albatrosses regurgitate a rich, fishy liquid. And then there are puffins. Puffins fly underwater into schools of small, slender fish, snatching them in their large beaks. A puffin catches one fish, then another, and another. The fish hang crosswise in the beak, sometimes dozens of them. Finally, the adult flies back to its nest, often miles away, to feed its payload to a single chick. But how do all those fish stay in the beak as the puffin goes on catching more? Credit goes to what's called the gape. It's a piece of stretchy skin where the beak hinges. Fish can be wedged in the gape, but it's so flexible that the bill edges still line up neatly. Even as the puffin opens its beak to catch more, the dangling fish won't slide out because both the strong tongue and the roof of the mouth are heavily lined with backward-angled spines. It's an image no nature photographer can resist, a puffin holding its fresh catch of silvery fish in that huge, colorful beak. But there's a lot going on behind the scenes to make that possible. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Time now for Gardening with Embark. And joining me in the studio is Embark Sustainability Society's Gardens Manager, Pablo Vimas. Welcome, Pablo.
Thank you.
It's we're now in week 41.
Correct.
Very close to the end of the growing season.
Yes, we are in the last 4 weeks and very busy in the garden, very busy. Trying to keep everything tidy, covering the garden beds with hoop houses.
Yeah.
And just on time, like yesterday, terrible rain that we had in the afternoon. So, yeah, I was very happy that all the garden beds are covered, which we prevent that the soil gets saturated with this rainfall.
And, that's going to be something that happens more and more as we get into the winter season.
Yes. Yeah. We are expecting, I think, quite a decent winter this time.
Yeah.
Environmental Canada says, it's a regular winter. So more rain, more snow, hopefully. And, hoping that there is a cold season.
Mm-hmm.
So all the insects, like particularly aphids, they die over the winter.
Yeah.
Last year was so warm that at the beginning of the spring we have aphids all over the place in the garden.
So as the season winds down, we start looking to different tasks. We talked about, making sure to keep the garden clean, and I think that paid off when we had the big rainstorm and that little saturating rain. I mean, if things are all over the place, it's going to make more of a mess.
Yes, pieces of wood tend to get very slimy and slippery, so we don't want that to be a reason that we can hurt ourselves in the garden.
And we also talked about doing some indoor gardening, but even as the season winds down, there's stuff we're putting into the ground because, of course, some things we start now at the end of the season to come up later on. So what are things like that we're looking at?
So at the moment, before this, we are planting garlic. We are planting garlic, and there are different types of varieties of garlic. So we loosen the soil. After this rainfall, I will wait 1 or 2 days after the rainfall in order to work the soil.
Yeah,
we have garden beds, so it's no problem. All the excessive water just drains through.
Yeah.
But if you have an in-ground plot, wait for 48 hours so all this water drains, and then you work the soil and start planting your garlic. This time of the year, it's time to find a spot where you're going to lock for the next 9 months with garlic.
Yeah.
So you plant your garlic two to three times depth. The depth is 2 to 3 times the size of the garlic.
Yeah.
And later you cover with leaves. So again, preventing that the soil gets eroded by the rainfall and snow. And we wait till next spring for seeing the shoots of the garlic coming up.
And then once we do pull up the garlic, what's our process then? Because, garlic sort of dry. Anyway, you tell me.
So we planted the garlic, and then, as I mentioned, we cover with leaves.
Yeah.
But as well, we need to put a stake somewhere that let us know that's garlic in there. Yeah. Otherwise, we come on a spring and we just uproot everything. By spring, so at the moment we planted the garlic, the garlic clubs will start shooting roots and settling themselves in the ground.
Yeah.
And then in 4 weeks, we will have the first frost and they go dormant until the next spring, where they will start, the temperature of the soil will start increasing, the garlic bulbs becomes active and start shooting leaves. And we will have a lovely leaf garlic shop pushing up through the mulch of leaves.
Yeah. And about when will we expect to start seeing those shoots coming up?
it depends how warm the winter is, but I will say by mid by mid-February, we will start seeing the shoots coming out. Yeah.
Great. It certainly is a year.